This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. After working pretty much without a break since February when COVID-19 went pandemic, Jefferson County Public Health Officer Dr. Tom Locke decided to finally take a few days off at the beginning of October to go camping and cycling. While he was away, the White House became the hottest COVID hotspot in the nation, and the president himself was hospitalized for several days with the disease. In this week's Compass, we talk with Dr. Locke immediately upon his return from his rest break about the dangerous messaging coming from the top level of government as case numbers rise nationwide, pointing towards a much-feared surge which could once again overwhelm our healthcare systems as we enter the cold months of the year. So now, let's go inside the Compass. Why don't we start off by just talking a little bit about like what the trends with COVID are currently nationwide and whether it really appears that we may be heading towards the kind of surge that we were fearing in the fall.
The national picture is not looking good, and the state picture here in Washington is not looking as good as we would like it to be. Nationally, COVID is intensely surging in the areas that were previously spared. So the Midwest, states like North Dakota and Wisconsin and Utah, these were the least severely impacted early on, and now they have the highest rates. But throughout the country, we're seeing a gradual increase, which is an ominous sign given the fact that we're heading into the season that we know is favorable for transmission of respiratory viruses. As the weather gets colder, as the days get shorter, people head indoors, and the virus is much more efficiently transmitted indoors than outdoors. And here in Washington State, the rates are going up as well. I just looked on the Department of Health website, so our reproduction number in the state is 1.3, which means that the pandemic's growing. At exactly one, it's in a balance. People are recovering as fast as they're becoming infected. But you know, now we're above that, and it's creeping up slowly. It's not a dramatic surge, but we're bracing for a steady increase in COVID-19, probably until February or March, and then it might start to trail off.
It seems like for a while anyway, although the infection rate seemed to be going up, the rate of hospitalizations and deaths were actually going in the other direction, or at least kind of holding steady. Is that still the case, or have the number of hospitalizations and deaths started to increase again as well?
Definitely in Washington State, those two trends are going in opposite directions, which is good. So the case rate is going up, but the death rate is going down. Nationally, both are going up, but not at the same level, you know, the 1,000 deaths a day that it had been in the middle of the summer in July. And the reasons are pretty clear to us why this is happening is, number one is the age ranges. So we're seeing a lot more young people becoming infected. And they're less likely to need hospitalization and much less likely to die from the infection. And then also the medical care is getting better and better. So that even of those people who end up in the hospital and have high-risk conditions for complications, the survival rate's going up because the medical care is getting better. So the survival rate on ventilators is going up, the ability to keep people from getting on ventilators, that's improving. So, and this is what we expect from medical science. You know, you learn as you go in a pandemic. That shouldn't inspire people to be reckless and to abandon precautions or to try to not avoid getting infected, because it still can be a very serious infection. But the death rate has gone way down from what we were seeing back in March.
Has the death rate come down so much as to give some veracity to President Trump's claim that this is now nothing more than the seasonal flu? I mean, you know, he's been really encouraging people not to worry about the virus.
That was an absurd and ignorant statement on his part, in that it's really not a matter of speculation at this point. We know that COVID-19 is at least five times more deadly than influenza. So that what we call the case fatality rate with COVID-19, it appears to be about 5 out of every 1,000, whereas with influenza, it's 1 out of every 1,000. But the big difference is, in a pandemic, everyone is susceptible to the new infection. And so conceivably, every American could get infected with COVID-19 if they haven't already been infected. Whereas in influenza, in a typical influenza season, only about 15% of the U.S. population gets infected because there's vaccines and there's prior immunity from previous years. And also, just not everyone gets exposed. So people are much less susceptible to influenza than they are to COVID-19 because it's been around so much longer. You know, it's an apples and orange comparison to the extreme. And it's really dangerous to equate the two because people are used to the flu and don't think too much about exposing themselves to it. Whereas with COVID-19, it's a much more serious condition. And we're seeing people who don't recover from COVID-19, these so-called long-termers, who have persistent symptoms for weeks or months after infection. We don't see that with influenza. When people get over influenza, they pretty much get over it completely.
Let's talk a little bit about those persistent symptoms, because I think it's, people have been thinking about this in a sort of you have it or you don't kind of way, without really contemplating the possibility of lifetime disability. So, I mean, you know, what kind of lasting damage are we seeing?
We're seeing a wide range of things. First and foremost is lung damage. So that people who survive, and especially people who have COVID pneumonia and who need intensive respiratory therapy or even ventilator support, the virus causes a kind of a scarring in the lungs, which makes the lungs less elastic and less able to do their function of gas exchange. And so people have persistent pain with breathing, shortness of breath, decreased exercise tolerance, those kind of things. We're seeing heart damage. In severe infections, the virus stiffens the wall of the heart. It makes it less able to pump at its full efficiency. And those changes, at least at this point, they're looking like they persist for months. We don't know if they'll be permanent or not. Some people suffer organ damage, kidney damage, liver damage. We think that's probably has to do with clots forming in those organs. And people can have, like, strokes. They can have clots can form and then break loose and go to the brain. So people can have out and out strokes, which cause permanent neurologic damage. And then finally, there are these really poorly understood immunologic conditions, such as the multisystem inflammatory condition that occurs in children, where it's like having an autoimmune disease, where all kinds of different systems in the body can be damaged by this over-exuberant immune activity. And this is still a relatively new infection, so we are learning all the time. Fortunately, a lot of people with COVID-19 have fairly mild, uncomplicated illnesses. That's the good news of it. It's also one of the reasons it makes it so difficult to control it, because you have these asymptomatic spreaders out there in the population that, if they're not masked up, they are spreading the virus and they don't even know it.
we're just entering, of course, also into flu season. I went out and got my flu vaccine last week. And I just wonder if you have any news for us about how, I mean, it is early in the season, but are we seeing any cases of flu yet? Or is the, I mean, I would think that the same precautions that everyone's taking about the COVID-19 would be really tamping down any flu we might be seeing. But
that's kind of what we're predicting, is, and we're really hoping that we have a very mild flu season. Because exactly as you say, all of these things we're doing in terms of masking and distancing and increased hygiene, those also protect from not only influenza, but all these different common cold viruses that circulate in the winter months. And one encouraging bit of data about that is that what went on in the Southern Hemisphere during our summer, of course, it was their winter, and in places like the temperate areas of the Southern Hemisphere have seasonal influenza just like we do. And so in areas like Australia, New Zealand, and Southern South America, Chile, they had virtually non-existent influenza seasons. Their influenza was reduced by 99%.
Wow.
So that's what we hope will happen here. But it's still very important for all of us to get influenza vaccination. It's a very safe vaccine. There is a huge amount of vaccine that's being produced this year. Almost 200 million doses will be available. It's not available all at once, but it'll continue to be available throughout the season. And everyone should get vaccinated, because not only is the prospect of getting flu and COVID-19 a dangerous thing, but every time someone gets flu or even a common cold, we have to differentiate that from COVID-19. So everyone who gets cold symptoms, we have to test them for COVID-19 to make sure it's not the coronavirus, and to make sure that person doesn't need to be isolated and they're contacts quarantine and tested, and all of those control measures. So if we have a lot of people getting fevers and coughs, it's really going to overwhelm our testing abilities.
I was going to ask you about that. I mean, I know certainly, like, early on in this, like, testing was a huge problem, and there was like delays of up to 2 weeks. Because I just went into the doctor actually for a minor little nagging respiratory thing I have going on. I had to get a COVID test last week, and I got my results, I think, in about 36 hours. So it's obviously come down considerably, and there was absolutely no problem getting a test like immediately. So it seems like at the moment anyway, we have a good supply.
It still has some precarious components to it. You know, we keep running out of different things like swabs or these tiny specimen transfer devices called pipettes that the labs need. But they've been doing a better job at the supply line. And Washington State is fortunate that we are kind of a biotechnology hub in the nation. So we have a lot of testing capacity in the state, and we're trying to maximize it. So the test you had done went to the University of Washington, which has a very large testing capacity. And also the hospital has a limited supply of tests that they can do in-house. So if someone is in the emergency room and needs a test urgently, hospital can do a test in a matter of hours. They don't use that for everyone because the test kits are limited for that. So things have improved dramatically since where we were in March and April, where our record was, we waited for one test result for 13 days it took, and the illness was completely over by the time we got the test result back.
Do we have any of those, like, you know, fancy 15-minute tests like they were using in the Rose Garden at that famous, seemingly super-spreading event?
There is a private clinic in Port Townsend that is offering the rapid test, what's called the antigen test. And it has its uses, but it also has its limitations in that it's not as sensitive as we say. It's not as able to pick up infection when it's actually there. It's not as sensitive as the lab-based test, which is called a PCR test. And a PCR test is actually able to amplify the sample. It can detect very small amounts of virus, whereas these rapid tests, they don't have that amplification component. They're just looking for proteins that are present on the surface of the virus. So you have to have a lot more virus in the sample for an antigen test to pick it up. If you have a rapid test and it tests positive, you know, you have the infection. But if you have a rapid test and you test negative, that does not rule out the infection. And what you need to do in that case, and what we do routinely, is you then take that sample or get another sample and send it off for PCR testing. And even then, PCR testing does not completely rule out the infection. PCR can miss infections as well. So we don't have any test that's 100% accurate.
So in other words, it's a really bad idea to do what the White House did, for those events where they say, okay, well, we're going to test everybody as they come in and prove to ourselves that everybody's okay, and then we can just all hug each other and shake hands and do all of the things that we always have done with impunity.
Yeah, it was a horrible idea. It even violated the licensure of the test. The test is only supposed to be used for people who have symptoms of COVID-19. So where they're sick enough to have enough virus in their system that it might be able to detect it. They're not useful at all for ruling out infection. It would have even been a bad idea for them to do what they were doing with PCR testing, because those tests, they rule in infection. If it's positive, it really is positive, but they don't rule it out. So their mistake was not doing all the other things in addition. They should have been masking and distancing and avoiding large gatherings and doing all the hand hygiene kind of protocols, but it fits with their general attitude, where they've just been in denial that this is real. You know, it's the only thing surprising to me is that this did not happen sooner.
So it kind of had the feeling of inevitability to it.
Right. And it's likely going to spread because by all accounts, they're doing an inadequate job of contact tracing. They're doing an inadequate job of infection control. And the price you pay for that is the outbreak continues. You know, if you don't contain outbreaks, they stay outbreaks.
Right. Well, and that brings me to another one of the questions I had, which is about like contact tracing and the authority that public health officials have to demand it. You, as the public health officer, have a certain amount of a lot of authority, actually, to, for example, shut businesses down. And the comment has been made, well, if the White House were anything other than the White House, public health authorities would just shut it down now.
That's very true. And all of those people who are close contacts, which is, you know, the Attorney General and the first family and all of these people, they should be in strict 14-day quarantine, which means they don't leave their homes, they don't go to work, they don't have close contact with anyone. And if they were in Washington State and they, you know, we start with a voluntary quarantine. So we tell people that they need to isolate if they're infected or quarantine if they're exposed. And if they don't do it, we have the authority to issue a formal health officer order, which compels the person to do it. Violating a health officer order is a misdemeanor criminal offense. You know, it can land you up to 90 days in jail. And even more significantly, we can go to a judge and say, this person's violating a health officer's order. And then you get a court order And then, you know, then you're talking a year in jail and thousands of dollars in fines and other whatever legal sanctions the judge wants to put on you. And we found in Washington State, and especially here in Jefferson County, the rates of compliance with our recommendations to isolate and quarantine have been extremely high. And I that's something I found gratifying, is people deep down have a lot of common sense and concern for one another and concern for the community. So virtually everybody we require to isolate and quarantine does so without being forced to with a court order. But I would not hesitate to issue an order for the, you know, the people in the administration who just plain refuse to quarantine. You know, they've had high risk exposures. Probably the attorney general is the most egregious. You know, he's had multiple high risk exposures, but he refuses to quarantine.
Well, I mean, let's take another example. I mean, in Washington State, if this were the governor and, you know, our attorney general and our state senators and so on, I mean, you know, like, who would have the authority to actually go in and arrest the governor?
We wouldn't arrest them without a court order, but the Thurston County health officer has the authority to issue a binding order to either isolate or quarantine to the governor. And then if they fail to comply with that, not only are they subject to criminal sanctions, but they're also, our protocol is to get court orders when people ignore health officer orders, because a court order has a lot more enforcement muscle to it. You know, there you can issue a bench warrant and the person can be arrested. Generally, what we would do is we would put a person into a mandatory isolation and quarantine facility. We would not want to put people into jail because we don't want to expose the other people in jail to the infection. It's very unusual that we have to do things like this, because people generally understand it's the right thing, and we support people. You know, we provide food and whatever kind of assistance they need. In some cases, lodging. You know, we have motel rooms that we contract with that people can use if they need a place to stay. And so that's the key. But the governor and every person in the legislature, by virtue of the fact that they are a citizen of the state and a resident of some county within the state, they are subject to the authority of a county health officer.
So presumably the same situation prevails in Washington, D.C., and it would be the local health officer who would have the authority to shut down the White House, for example?
That's where I my knowledge of this kind of has gaps, is how that sort of federal authority it seems that I'm sure Washington, D.C. has a health officer and has a public health department. I haven't seen them as being involved in this. And the CDC, which very often would play that role in a federal jurisdiction, they've been cast in the background. My understanding is they've had a team ready to assist the White House in contact tracing, and the call never came. The White House appears to be trying to do it all in-house. And they also appear to lack the expertise to do it correctly.
Well, we're going to run out of time, and I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the vaccines, because there's another area. I mean, you mentioned the CDC, and as we've seen in recent weeks, there's been a lot of political interference with science going on, including President Trump's repeated assurance that there would be a vaccine before the election, and he seems to be really doing everything he can to get an emergency use authorization out for at least like one vaccine to make that promise come true, even though if something like that were to happen, it seems like it would seriously undermine public trust in the vaccine that comes out. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about the timing of a vaccine and the process for testing and why it's important to have the extra couple of months at least of phase 3 trials before anything even gets an emergency use authorization.
Yeah, it's crucially important in that it's phase three really looks at the effectiveness of the vaccine. That is, does it really work? And number two, the safety of it. And you can only do that when you have high numbers of people and that you watch them for several months to look both for immediate vaccine side effects and longer term side effects. So at an absolute minimum, it's virtually impossible for any vaccine to complete that process before the very end of December. And even more likely, it's not going to be into January or February till we have vaccines that are available. And then, and even then, it'll be very limited availability. But if the vaccines prove to be effective, even that's not known yet, but if they prove to be effective and they have a acceptable safety profile, then they'll find some use. But you know what you allude to, the, this politicization of vaccination is a it's a disaster from a public health standpoint because you know already people are leery of a new vaccine like this, and we've seen the public willingness to take the vaccine. You know, with the Pew Charitable Trust has asked people, you know, whether they'd be willing to take the vaccine or not, and that number has dropped from about 75% to it's at 50% now. Only half the U.S. population is willing to take a vaccine if it becomes available. And that's not enough to stop the pandemic. So they have really harmed the effort to bring this pandemic to an end. But I want to reassure people that there are a lot of independent organizations that will be looking at this vaccine. And so we won't have to depend just on these government agencies controlled by the administration. We will have a lot of independent scientists looking at safety and effectiveness. And if they give a thumbs up for the vaccine, I personally would be very confident to take it if it's endorsed by the independent science-based organizations.
You've been listening to an interview with Jefferson County Public Health Officer Dr. Tom Locke. This is Steve Evans for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Saturdays at noon and repeats on Mondays at noon and 5 p.m. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.